coming up next on RCR. Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. In a topsy-turvy world, good old-fashioned ideas may seem foreign to some, but still make a lot of sense to many. Join Simon as he speaks with local and international guests to explore the values and perspectives that shape our world. Get your common sense fixed with conversations that celebrate democracy, freedom, and our fundamental rights. It's Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Speak Free. Great to have you back this morning, and what a morning, and what a week. In fact, we've just celebrated, of course, King's birthday, so I thought I'd make the show a bit of a King's birthday special, if you will. One of my very special guests is actually a very good friend of mine. Amongst other things, he was my best man. There's something personal. But I have Dr. Sean Palmer joining me to talk about all things monarchy, constitutional, and the crown. He's the head of Monarchy New Zealand. In fact, one of New Zealand's experts on the nature of the crown. So I thought, having had King's birthday just happen, we should have a little bit of a discussion about why this matters. I'm also sure there's going to be plenty of monarchists and republicans amongst you. So I'm hoping this might stir up a little bit of debate. And I would love to hear your views with what Sean and I talk about, or of course, if you have any questions for him. So if you do, make sure you email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio, or of course, you can always text to 2057. I also have a little bit of a quiz for you guys, a few questions around the monarchy here in New Zealand. So I'll be interested to hear how you go. Also, really pleased to have Tania Unkevich along. She's a New Zealand First MP. I have a little bit of a chat to her about why she's in Parliament. And then I have another special guest, a friend of mine from America. Bruce is calling in from the state of Maryland to tell me what's happening, or tell us what's happening in America. So look, tune in. We have a big show ahead of us. Well, so much to reflect on over the last week. I've in some ways been struggling what to think to discuss with you, not so much as lacking, it's just so many topics. I suppose the budget remains front and center in a lot of discussion. We've obviously had the Maori Party wanting to declare its own parliament, but also what I think is some quite worrying language. And you know, maybe I will touch on that, because I think it's important to couch this in the free speech space. And then obviously what we've been seeing in America, the Trump case, and now we see Hunter Biden going through the court. So yeah, quite a few things on my mind. Maybe I will start in that order then. I mean, the budget, I've been thinking about it a little bit more, and I was relatively positive about it last week when I was doing the very brief review of it, only a few hours after it had been released for our show on Friday morning. And I suppose I've become a little bit more worried by it, actually. You know, we've got a government saying one thing, but it doesn't completely add up in the numbers. And by that, I mean we've got a government now that's spending more in this budget than what was spent last year, or simultaneously we're talking about trying to reduce costs. We're trying to reduce debt, well, that's one of the goals, and yet more borrowing is happening in this budget. So those are high-level figures, but it just bothers me a little bit. And to be fair on the current government, they're indicating the trajectory they want to go. They're saying, look, yes, we do have to spend a little bit more and borrow more in the very short term, but we intend to dial that back. But I am a little worried. You may be able to pick that up in my voice. I mean, at the end of the day, a country that continues to spend more money than it brings in is in for a rough ride. And I keep using the very simple analogy of our own homes. If you're spending more than what you get in your income, you know you're in trouble. Then there's the whole issue around the cancer drugs too. I'm disappointed the funds weren't found, or even the political wherewithal to have just ring-fenced some of the enormous funding they are giving to health in general for the cancer drugs. I was just surprised. I think that's a little bit of an own goal, which I hope they rectify over the coming weeks and months, although that's going to be a challenge now, because of course once you signal to pharmaceutical companies that you want to buy their product, it makes negotiations rather difficult. And I say that as a former negotiator. Obviously, the Māori Party, worrying rhetoric at some levels. And why I say some levels is because, you know, if we start from a free speech lens, and this is Speak Free, you know, the Māori Party leaders and others are more than welcome to say they want a new parliament. They are more than welcome to express their, I don't know, disdain, is that the right word, of the current democratic structures. They're very welcome to say all of that. But I think where the line getting crossed is that the increasing level of violent suggestions that are coming through their language. So I mentioned, I think, last week in passing how, you know, imagery of guns, and the wife of the Māori Party co-leader, Rawiri Waititi, is just expletive-laden social media posts of late, basically saying that they've got to do everything to get power back. There should be almost no limits. I'm not going to read everything she says, but they're just quite disturbing rants, which, you know, I think are beginning to cross from free speech to incitement of violence. And what's really striking is, you know, our usual suspects like the Human Rights Commission, useless as they are, as many of you will know, I don't think they've actually know what a human right is if it hit them over the head. They're usually the first to jump on anyone they deem incorrect or racist. But in this case, they're utterly, utterly silent with, you know, what are pretty threatening suggestions from some within the Māori Party. So a very long way of saying they're welcome to call for new parliaments and so forth. Go for it. We're all free to make such requests. But there has just been that worrying slide into the violent language. And again, the usual suspects, the Human Rights Commission and others, seem remarkably, remarkably quiet. They just seem to pick and choose. But I think many of you will know that, well, as I said at the start, I don't think the Human Rights Commission really has much value to it at all. I think they're a bunch of activists, basically, who only pursue particular views on human rights. And I really want to stress that word particular. They pick and choose. You know, our most fundamental human rights have very rarely, if ever, and certainly in recent years, have not been supported by the Human Rights Commission. It's actually quite worrying. And, you know, a number of politicians, current and past, have noted we should get rid of it. And personally, I'd withdraw the funding from them. I think they're a waste of space. So those are just a few thoughts. We might get on to the whole American situation another time around the, you know, what's happening with the court cases. But those are just some thoughts at the moment. Again, free speech, the Māori Party and the budget.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
I'm delighted to welcome my next guest, Tania Unkevich. She is a MP in the New Zealand Parliament. So as I've got out, they've brought better talent in. And so Tania is my guest today. Amongst many claims to fame, she is a New Zealand First MP, List MP based in Auckland. She's already hit the ground running, incredibly busy. And again, it's my delight, Tania, to have you on the show. Welcome.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, Simon. Thank you.
Hey, with all new MPs, to many listeners and across New Zealand, people are new. I was there many years ago. Now yourself. So I would just love over the next few minutes to hear a little bit about you, what's drawn you into Parliament, what you're hoping to achieve. So without sounding too chronological, where did Tania Unkevich start from? What was your career before coming into Parliament?
Well, look, actually, I did so many things, to be honest. My background is commerce, and I specialised in accounting software. When MYOB first came into the country, I started selling, installing, and did it with hundreds of businesses. And that was a really good small business that I had going. And then in my mid-30s, because I was a bit of a personal development junkie, had my own stuff to sort out, I then studied to be a therapist. Had a lot of grief to deal with. And so that was in my mid-30s. And little did I know that was actually preparation for what was to come. And that was when my then husband, Phil, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And he passed away 5 months later when I was 40. So that was where my career began in speaking and writing. I wrote a couple of books when Phil passed away. And I've since written two more books on overcoming adversity and addictions and things like that. So I really am a Tania of all trades. You know, there's a commerce side of me, and then there's this counselling / life coaching side of me. I was a coach for Tony Robbins, so I did a lot of international coaching, business coaching and mentoring. writing, speaking, been on radio. So it's been a real mix. And I've just had a desire to help mankind. And, you know, then I just got to the stage in my life was, how can I do it on a grander scale? And the doors opened for me. And here I am sitting in Parliament. It's very much like that, to be honest. A decision was made and everything just opened up for me.
It's fantastic. Well, I feel inadequate already, including that you've done radio. We should probably be switching roles. Look, it says me, what a wonderful array of experiences. And obviously, sorry for the loss of your husband all those years ago. But at the same time, what an enormous amount of experience that you bring to our parliament. If I might make a comment, we need it. I actually think we need a breadth of experience. It's really refreshing. What was it like working or getting to know someone like Tony Robbins? What was he like?
Tony is a huge man with big teeth and a big personality. Honestly, it was hard work, but it taught me discipline. I really feel that the training I had as a Tony Robbins coach was definitely the toughest thing I've ever done, even harder than campaigning, believe it or not. And it the way they teach us how to coach, I think, is second to none. So you also coach so many people. You get really good at listening and identifying problems and helping people move forward in life. So I've got to say, those skills are some of the greatest skills that I bring into Parliament.
Oh, again, says me, I think they're vitally important. I used to use the word pastoral. Yeah. Quite a lot. A lot of the time of an MP, as you'll now know, is sitting, listening to people, which is possibly a surprise to listeners. MPs listen to people.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's so true, though.
Yeah. How have you found the adjustment, actually, into parliamentary life? Was it what you were expecting? Is it busier, different?
You know what? I didn't have any expectations, but I think because what I have done leading up to it and how hard I've worked in certain areas of my life and what I've had to achieve in short periods of time at times, you know, like writing books and things like that, I feel that I have slotted into Parliament quite nicely. I'm really disciplined and I feel you need discipline. I'm an early bird though. So the late nights, I must admit, has been an adjustment for me. And then, you know, I don't sleep in. If you go to bed at midnight, I don't sleep in. I'm still awake at 4 or 5. So by the time I get home, husband says to me, yeah, you look really bad. After a few days.
Ex-husband, I'm only kidding. No, with those sort of comments.
Oh no, he's hanging in there.
Well, actually, talk people through that, if you don't mind a little. I mean, I can sure. completely relate to it. Like you, I'm a morning person. But let people understand just the hours that you do, including you just had urgency last week. So yes. Explain people through that.
That was brutal, I have to say. Well, look, I fly down. I choose to just stay in a hotel. So I fly down on a Monday evening. I'm usually in the office by about 7 a.m. in the morning. And on a Tuesday night and a Wednesday night, we are in the house until 10 p.m. at night. And then the following day on a Thursday, we're there till 6. And then I get on a plane at 7:30 and I'm home late that night. Now, I've accepted that from the time I land on a Monday till the time I get home, I will have very little sleep and I will work nonstop. Now, I've accepted that, so it's okay for me, you know? And believe it or not, some days I don't have time to eat lunch. And you'll know what that's like. You just go from meeting to meeting and then you go into the house and, Tanya, you're speaking on this bill. And it's like, what's this bill about? You know, you've got an hour to prepare for it and really learn about it. So the adrenaline, you know, I find you've really got to manage your health and your self-care because your adrenaline goes up and down. And it's just accept whatever happens in those days. And it's tough. It's a hard, hard 3 days, but I kind of enjoy it, you know? I come home and I say to my husband, oh, I'm exhausted. And then after a day, I go, I'm ready to go back into the mush pit. You know, you really enjoy it. So
it's almost, I found, a bit of an addiction because everything you're saying, and again to listeners, it completely echo what Tanya's saying. There's no exaggeration. It's long hours. My funny thing was, like, you barely got to eat. And yet, for my case, I kept putting weight on. Very confusing. But it's busy, and I assume you're back on a Thursday night. So the time you've flown back, got back into to home, you're probably 9, even 10 at night sometimes. But you'll be straight back up again on Friday morning and across the weekend, because there's always local events to attend as well.
It's a 24/7 job, and you don't really slow down. Your mind doesn't slow down. You're always thinking about it. I start listening to the news at 5 a.m. every morning, and I'm listening to the news all day. I keep on top of everything that way, and it just doesn't stop. But then I also say to myself, you know, Tanya, you can just watch rubbish for 2 hours. And I do that, and that relaxes me. I watched a couple of really lame girly movies last week, and I noticed how it really relaxed me at the end of the night. So you do have to give yourself that bit of space and take that time out. Take care of your health for sure.
Oh, vitally important. And recently too, you've had urgency. So not finishing on a Thursday, you carried on right into the weekend.
Yes. So Thursday night, did we go to midnight? No, we didn't go to midnight on Thursday night. I believe we went till 10 p.m. on Thursday night. Then Friday night, we went to midnight. And then Saturday night, we went to midnight as well. This was all budget, post-budget debate, etc. So yes, we finished Saturday night at midnight, and I was on a 6 a.m. flight. So I managed to get 3 hours sleep and got on that 6 a.m. flight, came home, and it really felt like I'd flown to London and back by the time I got back in the weekend.
I think it's a really good explanation for people to understand. If you ever see an MP looking tired, I don't know about you, Tanya, but I've had people who would text or message or come through Instagram or something, and that have seen me on television, and they go, "You look terrible." So, oh, thanks. But it's like when you've worked those sort of hours week after week, it does exhaust you. It does exhaust you.
My husband said to me when I got back at Christmas, because we did a lot leading up to Christmas and urgency, he said, "You look the second worst I've ever seen you." And I said, "Okay, so what was the worst?" He said, "Well, when you came back from your Tony Robbins training, nothing beats that. But yeah, you look pretty bad, dear. You need to rest." So
I'm admiring your husband's ability just to speak so freely and not to be... It suffers some serious consequences.
No, yeah. Oh, I like the honesty, so it's good.
I'll jump in a moment, if you don't mind. I'd love to hear a little bit more about what drew you into Parliament. You talked a bit about service, but I was just curious, again, when you speak of the work you've done around Tony Robbins and counselling and helping people, writing books and so forth, I mean, it's probably a big question, Tanya, but, you know, what are some of the observations you've got about the human condition? What have you learnt about human beings? I know it's exceptionally broad. Are we strong? Are we resilient? Are we people who need greater support and love? I mean, what are some of the things that you've picked up on through all your experiences?
We all have needs, and it varies. And some of the greatest human needs that we have are love and connection. We all have a desire to be part of a community. Some of us have a desire for variety. Some of us have a desire to be in control. It's not so good. Some of us have a desire for significance. And these are the things that drive us and drive our behaviors. So if you can identify what is driving your behavior, then that makes it easier for you to make a change to your behavior. So, for example, I've worked a lot with people with eating disorders and eating issues, and I would always ask them, what is it that you are needing? What is it that the food brings you? And for many, it's love and connection. They have connection with food because they are so lonely, you know? So it's that's some of the greatest things that I've learned. And to know what your own needs are is a huge thing, because you can then understand why you do the things you do.
Well, there's a good challenge for me there, actually. I'm a philosopher by training and lots of pastoral work with my former life, but I've probably spent so much time helping other people, I've never put that question to myself.
For yourself, yeah. It's so valuable to know that about yourself, you know, and we all have a need for significance, which is okay. But when that is one of your top needs, that's not okay.
Yeah. It reminds me, actually, when I used to be a prison chaplain, in the old Mount Eden. And when you talk about what drives people, that used to be sort of an underlying discussion with the boys, particularly in the youth yard, is that how have you got here? And there was always lots of reasons, often terrible experiences in their lives, but there was an element of them trying to find a relevance, a community, a sense of purpose, sadly through crime. Yeah, sorry to put a negative one in there, it just resonated.
Well, you know, that gives them attention, and bad attention is better than no attention. And that's what drives people to do some of the things that they do.
Well, I'm going off on a real tangent here, but that just sparked another memory of a young woman used to deal quite a lot with young pregnant women as well, and she'd had so many children. I think she might have been up to number 6 by this time. And the stereotype, different fathers and stuff, but I was just having a chat to her, and I remember just asking to say, you know, what's going on in life and what's, you know, again, your motivations. And I'll never forget, Tanya, what she said to me. She said, "Nobody likes me. No one ever talks to me. But when I have a little bubba, when I have a little baby, people on the street come up to me." And I went, wow, you know, it was just a truth moment. Yeah. A truth moment for me. And it's always stayed with me. That was something that was driving her behaviors there, to get that response from the community, to feel part
of something. Yeah, it was her identity. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. Mm. Anyway, before we go off on a whole tangent on pastoral sides, so obviously a massive background. Our writer as well. We're going to have to, I'll make sure after this, we'll have to find out how to put some stuff into social media, let people know where we can find your books. But what then drew you to Parliament? You hinted at the start. I mean, did one day you wake up and go, Parliament, here I come? What was the catalyst? What was that liminal moment?
Well, I was thinking about, you know, the books help mankind on a greater scale. But then I started thinking, it was around the 2017 mark, thinking maybe my brother was saying it too. He says, "Tan, politics might be a good avenue for you if you want to keep serving." And I was thinking of that. Then my parents both started getting unwell. So that didn't really work. But I did start following politics more. And it was around 2020, 2021 that I found myself to be a political orphan, because I didn't like what was happening in New Zealand. And something then sparked inside me. It was actually May 2021 that I made the decision to do it. I said to my husband, "What do you think?" He said, "Go for it." I said to my brother, "What do you think?" He said, "It's time." 2 months after that, in July 2021, I discovered that New Zealand First were coming back, that Winston Peters was coming back. I thought he was retired for good.
Oh, never. Says me to you, you know I'm better. You never write Winston off.
No, Lazarus. That's another good name for him. And that happened on the July the 10th. It was the synchronicity that happened in order for me to find out that he was coming back. That night I read everything about New Zealand First's website, and I looked at myself and said, "Gee, Tanya, you're an intelligent woman, yet you've gone and voted the same way for decades. You didn't really do your research." And I realized how aligned I was with their policies. Anyway, that was July the 10th, 2021. The following month, my father passed away. And then we all got locked down. And then everything happened. And then I thought, gosh, I don't think the political thing's going to happen. Then my mother passed away. Then things happened. Then I decided to write my third and fourth books. The fourth book, sorry, was already in the making, but I ended up writing a third book in that time. And then something happened towards the end of 2022. I said to Grant, "I either go to the New Zealand First conference or I don't." I went to their conference, and within 12 hours, this is the party for me. I'm going to run in the next election.
I think it's fantastic. I mean, it's sad, although it's very much human condition, that there are tragedies or sadnesses in lives. Obviously, the passing of parents, going through that a bit myself at the moment, elder parents and their issues, it's sad. But it's funny, it's also a time of a lot of change.
Unbelievable.
It is a catalyst.
Unbelievable. And, you know, because I took care of my parents so much in the last 5 years of their life, I couldn't be doing this now, if I was still looking after them. And so the timing, everything, the synchronicity, and I made sure I told my mum and dad before I passed away. And I told my mum that I was thinking of running with Winston. And she goes, oh, in her Croatian accent, oh, I like Winston. He's handsome. And so I kind of got her blessing, I suppose. I think she had a bit of a crush on him. And anyway, so I it just happened. And I just worked hard. And I focused on what it was that I wanted, and here I am.
And so, well, firstly, I think it's great. I'm a great believer in the multiplicity of parties. I've always been struck by the James K. Baxter poem where he talks about Labour mum and National Dad. It's sort of that people just get into this funny rhythm, but actually there are other parties and other views. And could I say, you're probably one of the rare, there's a rarity in New Zealand is someone who's actually gone and read fully a party's policy and then made decisions.
Well, look, you know, it really shocked me because I actually asked myself the question, how come I haven't voted for New Zealand First before, you know? Always loved Winston, but I just mindlessly went along and did what I've done every other year. So it was a big wake-up call for me. And I thought, well, if I do it, there's a lot of other people out there who do the same thing.
Well, clearly enough, because you guys are back, you're back in Parliament.
I know. Isn't that great?
Well, I just think when I go around, the number of people who speak about New Zealand First is quite striking. I suppose I'm a known political, well, not a figure, but I'm known politically, so people are wanting to talk about it. But it's certainly got people chatting and actually engaging in policy. So maybe off that, because conscious of your time as well, I mean, what is it? You know, early on now, but what is it that you're hoping to achieve in Parliament? What are some of the aims that you can talk about?
Me personally, I really like being a voice for people who feel that they don't have a voice. And as you may have seen, I'm speaking up in certain areas to do with women's spaces, privacy, safety, children's privacy and safety. I'm speaking up on topics to do with the COVID inquiry. So I'm speaking up on topics that some find controversial, but I don't mind speaking up about it because someone has to do it. And I love speaking up for, I have a real heart for people who are at the end stage of their life. So I'm visiting a lot of hospices. I have a love for the elders. I mean, my parents were everything to me. They were probably the babies I never had. So as they got older, I really developed a huge respect for seniors, even more on what it must be like for them as they get towards the end stage of their life, you know? So I have a real love for that group in our community, and I will just be an advocate.
Which I think is wonderful. Look, I'll be honest, I think it's a rarity at times in Parliament. That's my own view, and I'm always, it's one of the reasons I've got you on, is detected very quickly early on and from others who have spoken about you. You're passionate, you're driven, there's a focus, and that advocacy for people often in need. And might I say, for a lot of listeners, the COVID inquiry is a big, big deal. And I think they'll be thrilled to know that someone's there advocating. And as you say, for women, knowing what a woman is always a good start. Yes. Yeah, but advocating for women, for children, I just think it's great. If I can ask, are you coming across a bit of resistance in those spaces, including of how we care for the elderly, like palliative care and so forth?
I think the resistance might be just the deafening silence. You know what I mean? And there's definitely trolling happening online. That's really started. However, that means I'm doing good work. You know, if no one was throwing stones at me, then that means I'm not making enough noise. So I'm okay with that. But yes, I do find that there is a lot of silence. I wish that there would be a few more voices, but that's fine. I'm going to lead the way if I have to, Simon, you know?
I think there's a fearlessness already that I can sense in the work you do. And again, it's only my view, but we need more of that in Parliament. I love my time there, Tanya, but I was struck by how many didn't seem to come in with a strong view on on anything, nor being prepared to speak up on issues. And personally, I didn't mind. It was different views to mine. It was just like, speak up. Why are you here?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, look, I'm Croatian, remember? We're loud, we're passionate, we swing our arms around, we eat a lot.
I think that's wonderful. Well, look, I think that's probably a good place to end this interview. I know that you have to carry on. You've used the word service many times. I think for listeners to understand that Tania's already very busy in these early months of Parliament and service and other things to do. But Tania, I'd love to have you back on at some point to hear a little bit more your work and advocacy around, obviously, the COVID review.
Yes.
Around women's spaces, safety of children and so forth. So look, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. And I'd love to come back. There's so much to talk about. As you know, I talk a lot, right? So there's plenty to share.
To be honest, it's a gift. It truly is a gift and something our parliament needs. Because that's the other irony, isn't there? There are some MPs that you basically never say boo. It's like, well, again, what are you doing here?
And then here comes the Croat.
Tania, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
So listeners, as you know, I'm doing a bit of a King's Birthday special. Obviously, having just celebrated King's Birthday, I thought it would be a good theme. And we've got Monarchy New Zealand's Dr. Sean Palmer coming in to have a good long chat with me. So I thought I'd do a little quiz for you. I've got 10 questions here, which obviously I'll read through, see how well you do with them, note down your answers, and at the end of my interview with Sean, once he comes in, we'll go through those questions. So if you've got pen and paper, here are the quiz questions. Number one, how many times has Charles visited New Zealand? So that's how many times has Charles visited New Zealand? Second question, which royal went to school here in New Zealand at Whanganui Collegiate? So which royal went to school here in New Zealand at Whanganui Collegiate? Number three, how many sovereigns have there been since the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi? So that's how many sovereigns, so how many kings or queens have there been since the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi? My fourth question to you, what is the name of New Zealand's current Governor General? Then question number five, who was the first king or queen of New Zealand? So that's who was the first king or queen of New Zealand. The sixth question, who is third in line to the throne of New Zealand? Then question seven, name all Prince William and Catherine's children. So name all of Prince William and Catherine's children. Question eight could be a bit tricky. Question eight is asking, is Charles the King of the United Kingdom or King of New Zealand? Question nine, is Charles an Admiral of the Fleet, Field Marshal, and Air Marshal in New Zealand? So is Charles an Admiral of the Fleet, a Field Marshal, and an Air Marshal in New Zealand? And the final question, question 10, if Prince George becomes George the Seventh, is that the highest number of any name? So I'll just read number 10 out again. If Prince George becomes George the Seventh, is that the highest number of any name? So there you go, guys, 10 questions. And once I've had Dr. Sean Palmer from Monarchy New Zealand come in, I'll get him to answer the questions and let's see how we all go.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome my next guest on the show. It's Dr. Sean Palmer, amongst many claims to fame. He is the head of or chair of Monarchy New Zealand. He's a man who's done his doctorate here in New Zealand because he's actually Canadian originally, but now a New Zealand citizen. He did his doctorate in the nature of the Crown and the Commonwealth. But amongst others, I don't know if it's a claim to fame, Sean, but you were also my best man at my wedding.
It was quite an experience.
But unfortunately, listeners, we're not going to be discussing my wedding today, as we have touched on a bit earlier, with King's Birthday having just happened. I wanted to actually keep, if you will, that royal
flavor going. And sort of the jokes or the light elements aside, I wanted to bring Sean on to talk about why the monarchy is important in the modern day. And again, to declare my hand, I've known Sean for a long, long time, and I've also been involved with Monarchy New Zealand. So I'm a staunch monarchist. Some of you might be going, oh no. But we're hoping over the course of the next few minutes to sort of explain, I think, why both of us, Sean, see the value in the monarchy in New Zealand. And we're going to come from it from a constitutional monarchy side rather than a royalist side. And Sean will touch on it. But Sean, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So, well, firstly, what did you do for King's birthday?
Well, I took the day off, the whole day. The whole thing. I said, I'm not coming into work. And they were all fine with that.
Did Charles have any say on that?
No. I don't think he got the day off.
No, that would probably be true, actually. No, again, I don't. So as you can see, we get on quite well. So we hope this will be, and it should be, a serious chat. But no, I actually just took the day off as well. It was a chance to relax with family, get some gardening done. But, you know, King's birthday is an important part of our calendar because it recognises an important part of our system. But I think before we get into it, it would probably be good for listeners to understand a little bit about yourself and why you are actually an expert. You are an expert in this country, I would argue, one of the very few experts on the nature of constitutional monarchy. So let's let listeners know a little bit about you.
As you mentioned, I'm originally from Canada. But I came to New Zealand quite some time ago to do a master's, and I enjoyed it so much. I stayed and did a PhD. They were both on the role of the monarchy in modern democracies. And I have been ever more convinced through those studies and through events that have unfolded in the past many years of what an extraordinary system it is. It is really, when we get right down to it, it is the very best system of government ever tested anywhere in the history of the world. That is the simplest way that I can put the value of the monarchy. And I suspect over the next little while, we'll probably drill into what makes it the best in the history of the world.
Well, that's a bold claim. It's a bold claim, and I know some listeners will be going, oh, yeah, okay. So I encourage, tune in, guys, keep listening. We'll tease some of this out. And obviously, you can always get in touch with me and through me to Sean through inbox@realitycheck.radio, or, of course, you can text at 2057. Let us know what you think. But let's start then with the basics, Sean. I mean, you've done your studies over many, many years about the nature of the monarchy. And when, in particular, we're talking about the constitutional monarchy. And I mentioned just a few moments ago, there's a difference between being, if you will, a constitutional monarchist and a royalist. Mm-hmm. Would you want to just quickly explain that for people?
Well, I think there are a lot of different reasons that people support the institution of the monarchy. And, you know, they all have their merits, these different reasons. Some of them may be that they like the celebrity aspects of members of the royal family. That's where I would tend to lean towards. That's a sort of royalist perspective. What are they wearing? What are they doing? Who are they feuding with? The stuff that
they'll be feuding with Harry and Meghan, won't they?
I think everybody's doing that. You know, it's the sort of stuff that gets into the tabloids and in the newspapers. From my perspective, you know, there are other angles to consider. You know, there's the pageantry and the pomp and ceremony, which, let's face it, the monarchy does very, very well. And that's got a lot of value in it. There's the history, there's the culture. Many people look at it and say, oh, well, my family came from there originally, and I like to have the connection. And that's a fine reason. I'm not going to dispute anyone's reasons for supporting the monarchy. But for me, the most important reason, and the one that I'm most interested in, is the role of the monarchy in our constitution, our structure of government, and the role that it plays particularly in the defense of democracy, because that's an angle that's not seen very often. For every tabloid headline, for every 100 tabloid headlines, there might be an article that talks once about the value of the monarchy to democracy. You know, it's just not covered very much, partly because I think people don't think it's very interesting. Constitutions, that tends to put some people to sleep, but it's an incredibly important part of our society. And in many ways, we're lucky we don't have to think about it. There are multitudes of countries around the world where people do worry about their country, the stability of their government, their constitution every day. And we don't ever have to do that. And so it's very easy to overlook how wonderful the system is that we have. And, you know, some people ask me, what's the point of the king's birthday? Why have a holiday for that? I say, if nothing else, it gives us one brief moment to go, oh yeah, we are a monarchy. And we've got a pretty great constitution and country. And those things are interconnected.
I think we might tease a bit of that out. I mean, for all the Republican sentiments and people, particularly in New Zealand, I suspect the same in Canada and Australia, we'll poo-poo the monarchy and make light of it. But I'm always struck, actually, with King's Birthday. Of course, it used to be Queen's Birthday. Since Queen Elizabeth passed away, we've had the name change, and listeners will be familiar too. We no longer have Queen's Councils, we have King's Councils. But King's Birthday, people get into the swing of it. You go through all the shops and they've got pictures of Charles and crowns, and I think we secretly like it. And maybe the other more serious point is the monarchy, that the system of monarchy is actually deeply ingrained into New Zealand. But I think your key point that you were trying to get to, the holiday aside, is this is an important part of our democratic structure. And I think we should tease that out a little bit more for listeners. But I really liked your point that we don't wake up in the morning worrying about our democracy. And, you know, if people have followed me over the years, you'd have heard some of my speeches where I think New Zealanders take a lot of this for granted. Our democracy, our electoral system, our freedom and rights, we certainly have taken those for granted. We wake up in the morning not worried. And part of it, I think we have to stress the monarchy is part of it. So, yeah, tease that out for listeners. Why is the monarchy helping our democracy?
It helps in a raft of different ways. I suppose we can start by keeping in mind that it is really the foundation on which the Constitution was built. It is the system of government that we inherited from our ancestors. Everything in terms of political power revolves around the monarchy. You know, the actions that are taken by the government of the day are given effect. They're given authority by the king and or his governor general here in New Zealand. You know, any law that's passed, sure, it passes the legislature. It's not a law until it's signed. That signature is not a rubber stamp. It's not simply guaranteed. There have been questions raised by governors general in the past about various laws. We know that monarchs have occasionally asked our prime ministers and elected officials, are you sure this is what you're wanting? Is this the correct direction to go? Of course, I'll support it if you believe it is. But there is that little bit of a check.
It's not a veto, is it? It's not like the presidential system that you might see in America.
Exactly. It's not a veto. A veto is very much a sort of sledgehammer. It really grinds everything to a halt. And our system of government, I think, assumes goodwill of our elected officials and says, right, well, we will guarantee to you the power that you need to govern the country as long as you stay within what we would consider the constitutional norms. You know, what stops a prime minister from simply saying, I'm going to pass a law which says we no longer need any elections? You know, some countries around the world say, well, the courts will stop him. And the response I would have to that is that the courts don't have any tanks. So a court can issue whatever statement it wants, but if it were really to come down to a difficult situation, you do need that final executive authority. And that is what is held in reserve by the monarch and the governor general. It isn't handed to the prime minister or the cabinet to do as they wish.
So in many ways, I mean, I get this all the time when I'm out and about. You know, there's people saying to me, certainly when I was in Parliament, that, you know, a government of the day would pass certain legislation and they would be asking that the Governor-General or at that time the Queen should stop the bill, should override it. They to me, were acting a bit like an American president. And so that veto power, another force. Ours, from the way you've described it, Sean, is more subtle. The King, or the Queen in the past, but the King today operates with Parliament and with the will of the Parliament. That's why he has ministers. So when we talk about the Minister of Finance or the Minister of Education, they are there to minister or give, if you will, advice to the King. And he works under that advice. So he's not a an autocrat. He doesn't have all this enormous power to just wield around at his whim. He does it through his elected government, the Parliament. But you are saying that, you know, if there was a real push comes to shove, he does have a few tools up his sleeve. So one of them, you're saying he can give them advice.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there's a little phrase they use about it, isn't there?
There is, that the monarch is welcome to encourage, to warn, and to be consulted. Those are the sort of rights of a modern democratic monarch. And it is known throughout the countries that the king is king of, that in the past half century, all of those powers have been used by Queen Elizabeth II or her governors general in these different countries, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. But I like what you say about it. It's more subtle than that. It is a much more negotiated arrangement if there's a constitutional crisis. There isn't that sledgehammer that just comes down and vetoes everything. There's much more discussion about it. But I mean, ultimately, in a democracy, a democratic monarch wants to see the democratic will of the people expressed. So these powers are very rarely used, these reserve powers, but rather like a fire extinguisher. You know, a fire extinguisher hopefully is very rarely used in your kitchen, but that doesn't mean that you're going to throw it out. If you say, well, I haven't had a fire in 20 years in the kitchen, we don't need this fire extinguisher anymore. And that's very much what's happening in our system of government, is that we have an understanding the monarch will assent to laws that have been duly passed by Parliament. But if those laws were to overstep the mark, if they were going to be unconstitutional, if they were going to, you know, undermine democracy in a significant, verifiable way, then it is reasonable to think that possibly even just behind the scenes, there will be a royal or a vice-regal word mentioned to say, you know, are you sure this is the correct direction to go? Because it does seem to be rather concerning.
Yeah, and I can say as a former politician, you know, again, I suppose I want to get again, I'll use that word nuance across to people. I'll make it as a statement. You don't want a king or a queen making the decisions of what they do not like. Mm. As I say, so many people have come to me, oh, I just wish the Governor General would strike this silly law down. It's like, well, no, you don't want that because, you know, what's the next law they're going to strike down at a whim? Again, it's important to respond to the Parliament. But if some government, God forbid, tried to pass some terribly anti-democratic law, as you said, it's, you know, removing elections, for example, I think the mere threat from a king or a queen to say, actually, I won't sign this, which of course would become public, would become a major scandal. Like, I don't think a government could survive is what I'm trying to say. So the monarch doesn't have to do much, but just the sheer statement, if you will, I'm grasping for words here, the intention to say, hey, this is an overreach, I have to tell the public I won't sign the legislation.
And better than that, not only will it become public, but really the single most important power a modern monarch has is the ability to call an election. Now, our Governor General does it in New Zealand, usually on behalf of the King. And so I lump the Governors General in with the same powers that the monarch has. Usually an election is called at the request of the Prime Minister on the date of the Prime Minister's choosing. But again, if something terribly undemocratic was happening, something really, really problematic, it's perfectly reasonable to think that the Governor General or the monarch might say, well, hang on a minute now, this is very controversial, this is potentially dangerous, this is possibly anti-democratic, why don't we put this issue to the people? Let's have an election 6 weeks from now, right? Let's dissolve Parliament, let's have an election, and you can bet that whatever this issue was, that will be front and center at that election. There would be no hiding it, there would be, you know, no way. It would essentially be a referendum on that idea. And if that idea were to pass, you know, if the government were to be re-elected on the policy of instituting this position, there would be really very little that anyone could do to fault the system. You know, the monarch would say, all right, it has gone to the people. The people have chosen this. This is the way they want to go. The monarch does not have dictatorial autocratic powers. They will follow the democratic requests of the people. So, I mean, really, when we get right down to it, that is probably the single most important power that a constitutional monarch has, is just an emergency election if one is needed. And very few systems outside of constitutional monarchy have the capacity to do that.
And I think it's obviously taken us a few minutes to get to this. As you can see, or not see, listeners, as you can hear, of course, it's like peeling an onion. This is actually quite a, not only a delicate, but actually it's a paradoxical. It's quite a modern institution, I'd argue, but of course has an enormous history. There is a delicateness to it with anything in democracy, but it's also quite robust, but there's many, many layers to it. But I would argue too, none of this is really theoretical. And we might just look to a couple of overseas examples to illustrate that to people. So, you know, Sean's fundamental point is if there was one key factor which makes a king or queen important, is that they can call elections. But as he also noted, and as I've noted to listeners, I'm generally in agreement because I'm a monarchist, a constitutional monarchist as well. They do act at the will of the people. And again, I just keep coming back to that because I know many listeners have often put to me in the past, why did the Governor General not step in on this circumstance? Or why did the King or Queen not act and stop these things happening? That the bar for that to happen is so, so high. It's not disagreeing with government policy. That's not where we want to end up. It is so, so high. And you talked about calling elections. In many ways, that was the Australian context a few years ago. Some of you who were around in the 70s with Kerr and
Whitlam. Yes, absolutely. You know, there was a very good example, and it has been fudged in history and in the retelling. It has been given an awful lot of spin, particularly because one participant lived for many, many years afterwards, and the other died quite young. And so, you know, his perspective, the Governor General's perspective, really did not get all that much attention. So the Kerr Whitlam affair in Australia in 1975.
Was it Gough Whitlam? Did I get it wrong with Kerr?
No. It was Gough Whitlam was the Prime Minister.
That's why I'm mixing it up.
So, so the Gough Whitlam affair in 1975 in Australia is a very good example of where a Prime Minister began to demonstrate what we would consider perhaps undemocratic tendencies, perhaps a cavalier attitude towards Parliament. Maybe that's the best way to describe it is, you know, the Australian Parliament has two chambers that are both elected, the House of Representatives and the Senate. The Prime Minister is drawn from the House of Reps, and he had a majority there. And he was trying to pass a budget in 1975, which is a critical test of any government. You must be able to pass a budget. If you do not have the support required to pass a budget, then your claim to the title of Prime Minister is very tenuous at best. He tried for many, many months to pass a budget. He got it through the House, which he controlled, but he couldn't get it through the Senate, which he didn't control. And for months, this dragged on. The Prime Minister was unable to spend money. And while that might have been great for Australia's bank account, the problem is, you know, you're essentially going bankrupt sitting on a pile of money. The tax money is there, but you can't spend it because it's all spent through the budget. So who's paying the police? Who's paying the military? Who's paying the teachers? Who's paying the doctors? You know, any publicly funded office, you know, this all has to come through the budget. So anyway, for months and months, this drags on, and he refuses to negotiate with the Senate. And eventually, as they were coming up to the Christmas break, it was about the middle of November, and in Australia, as is quite common here, the House rises before Christmas and doesn't come back for quite some time. And this would mean that this protracted dispute would have kept going. And the Governor General felt that something had to be done here. And he again spoke to the Prime Minister and said, will you negotiate with the party that controls the Senate? Will you pass this budget? There has to be some expenditure put forward. And the Prime Minister, who from the sounds of it was a rather pig-headed gentleman, said, I will not. I am the Prime Minister. I control the lower house. It is not for me to bend to the Senate's will. They will bend to mine, which again doesn't sound terribly democratic or at the very least not very realistic. Anyway, the Governor General felt that this had gone on too long and fired the Prime Minister on the spot. He said, you know, I'm sorry that that's your position. I will have to determine your commission. And you are no longer Prime Minister. And it is reputed that Whitlam said, I will call the palace. And the Governor General said, well, you may try, but it is not common for the Queen to take the calls of former Prime Ministers, which, you know, made that all the more clear as to what had happened to Whitlam. Anyway, immediately following that, the Governor General brought the Leader of the Opposition from the House of Representatives in, and it was his party that controlled the Senate. And he said to the Leader of the Opposition, I will make you Prime Minister now on two conditions. The first is that you pass Whitlam's budget exactly as it is. It has gone through the House, so that part's finished. You must now let that budget go through the Senate, so that it is his budget, that he was Prime Minister, it is his budget that goes through. That's the first thing. And the second requirement is that I require you to request an election of me immediately so that we pass that budget, we solve the financial crisis, and then we will immediately have an election and we will let the people decide what's going on. And the Leader of the Opposition said, yes, and became the prime minister for what I gather was a couple of hours. The budget was passed. The election was called. It was at that time that former Prime Minister Whitlam considered this a royal coup. He said, this is outrageous. This is a royal coup. Well, I have to say, when you look at it, that's really incredibly disingenuous. It is really offensive to anyone who has ever lived through an actual coup.
But I think that's that's sort of the fundamental point throughout this. I mean, firstly, it's actually quite used. Again, for slightly older listeners, you'll be familiar with this Australian case. It's often quoted, but I think often misrepresented. And I think first and foremost, Sean, you've given a good history on it. But the second, which is the reason we started this, is ultimately this was no coup. This was no takeover by the Queen or her Governor General or at the time the opposition. The only thing that really happened was a new election was called.
And I think that's really the critical element here, is that no coup anywhere in the history of the world has immediately been followed by an election. That, you know, nobody holds a coup for the sake of calling an election. And that is exactly what happened there. It was interesting. The Australian people backed the decision and returned the former leader of the opposition back into the prime ministership, and the country went on. But they pilloried the governor general in the years to come. As an experienced politician, Whitlam took every opportunity there to belittle the situation. But it was an example of that fire extinguisher. You know, there was a fire breaking out, and the governor general said, right, we have to resolve this in the most democratic way we can. We didn't hijack the budget. We didn't change the budget. His budget went through, and then there was an election. That's really a triumph of democracy. Far from a failing, that was a triumph of democracy.
I suppose that's the core argument, isn't it? That, you know, and look, there'll be different views out there, but the core argument here is that this monarchical part of our democratic structure allowed this to happen in a way that actually resolved itself. Mm-hmm. I suppose there's a couple of other points that we should touch on. And one is, this is ultimately a real person. So in other countries that don't have a monarch or a sovereign or a king or queen, you can alternate the language, they have presidents or whatever, or they have constitutions, they have oaths to flags and all sorts of concepts. In the likes of New Zealand, we have a real person.
Absolutely.
And so I suppose, one, just to tease that as an idea, but secondly, to give again a real life. Actually, let's start with a real life example, but it might illustrate what I'm saying, because again, people in America pledge fidelity to the Constitution. Well, that's lovely, but it's a piece of paper. And to be slightly facetious, a piece of paper is not going to turn up in court number one tomorrow. But when you have a king or a queen, they're a real, living, breathing person. And a really good example of this comes out of Spain, where there was a military coup years ago. So take us through that. I don't know, by the way, listeners, why we're talking about coups so much, but it's fascinating nonetheless.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, a coup is the means by which a democracy ceases to be a democracy. And I think how you handle a potential coup or an actual coup determines the success of your government. You know, every country works perfectly well right up until the moment that it doesn't. And, you know, you hit a speed bump on the road, and are you going to end up swerving into the ditch, or are you going to recover and continue on happily? You know, the Spanish example is a really interesting one, because it illustrates the value of having a real living, breathing person as the sort of central authority in your country. Some people pledge allegiance to a flag, some to a constitution, some to a country, which, I don't know, that could be an outline on a map or dirt. I don't know. You know, there are many things that people use as a placeholder for a monarch when they don't have one?
Well, it's being talked, sorry to interrupt, we need to get to the Spanish example, but, you know, in New Zealand, there's talk about generating a constitution and that we'll have allegiance to that instead of the king or to the Treaty of Waitangi or to vague concepts of what it means to be New Zealand. Again, they're not living, breathing, real people, they're concepts.
And worse yet, they can't speak for themselves. Right. All of these things generally have to be interpreted by other people, usually judges, certainly the upper echelons of power. That may not actually be the most democratic way of going about setting up a country. So look, the Spanish example is a really interesting one. You know, Franco had been in power until, 1975 or thereabouts as a dictator. And he handed power over to King Juan Carlos. And I think most people believed that Franco did that because he thought that the king would rule as a dictator following him. And King Juan Carlos stunned everyone by saying, no, I will be a constitutional monarch. We're going to have democracy in this country. And that was incredibly popular. The country grasped it and flourished for several years until Franco's generals and other subordinates came to realize that they had lost all of the power that they had once enjoyed. And they said, you know, maybe we should try to get that back. And so the military launched a coup. It was called the Colonel's Coup. And I think it was about 1981, 82, somewhere in there. They stormed Parliament in Madrid and they took hostages and they tried to control other key infrastructure around the country. As it was progressing, the king made a very, very clever move. He put on his military uniform. He is, of course, the commander of all of the Spanish military, as most monarchs are in their countries. They are the top authority in the military. And he went on television and he said that he was speaking directly to the military. And he said, I know that you are getting conflicting orders. Some people are telling you to do this and other people are telling you to do that. Well, I am at the top of the chain of command. And if you follow my orders, you cannot be accused of wrongdoing because you have followed the orders of the senior most officer. And I am telling you now to put down your weapons and to go back to your barracks. And it is astounding, but that clarity played a critical role in ending that coup. It collapsed very, very quickly after that. Military support at the lower levels evaporated. And it was a big part of why the King of Spain was tremendously popular for decades afterwards, because he spoke out on behalf of democracy. You know, it's all well and good to have democracy written in your constitution, but the constitution can't speak up. Judges could interpret it, but they could be accused of political bias. They could have the, you know, this influence.
So what you're really saying is that there's no ambiguity when you have a king or a queen. And we're talking here, and I think it's really important to stress to people, we're talking within a democratic constitutional system. We're not talking about autocratic kings and queens and sheiks and so forth. This is in a democratic system like our own. And New Zealand, by the way, shares King Charles with 14 other countries. So that's even more particular. But we're talking within the democratic structure. But having a real person removes ambiguity, because just about any other replacement, a treaty, a constitution, a flag, as you say, can't turn up itself. It can't turn in front of the cameras and say, soldiers, go home. But secondly, it's mediated. I really liked that word earlier. Any constitution has to be mediated through some groups of people. And maybe that takes me then to the next part, because we've talked quite a bit around, obviously, the king and queen like that of Spain, have been a real person. They can speak for themselves. We've talked about how the monarch holds really multiple powers, but one that's so critical. You talked about it as a fire extinguisher, that is calling elections. But a third point for me is that apolitical. The king, so Charles is not a politician. I say this as an ex-politician. And, you know, more often than not, Sean, when you have debate in New Zealand, there's always a talk about, well, replace the king with a elected New Zealand head of state. And I'm aghast at that because you're going to end up, I would argue, and by the way, push back if you like, but we're going to end up with another politician. You're going to end up with President Helen Clark or President John Key. We're going to end up with another class of politician, but the king sits above that. Well, I should phrase it a question rather than a statement. Is the king apolitical?
Oh, yeah. No, look, I mean, I think that is a really significant angle to consider. If we are going to let the politicians write a new constitution to govern politicians, you can be very confident of what that document is going to look like. You know, it's kind of a no-brainer. They're not going to work terribly hard to limit their own powers. They're going to happily find positions for their friends and allies. And, you know, this is where you see in a lot of republics around the world, the presidency is just a sinecure, a retirement post for a former political leader. I mean, look, you know, the current president of Ireland was the former president of the Labour Party of Ireland. Now, he seems to have done an excellent job. You know, I wouldn't say I have any particular problems with him. But in terms of representing the nation of appearing in all senses to be nonpartisan, I don't think somebody who's been the leader of a political party can claim that. You know, that's just not very realistic. So, you know, yes, we could expect to see politicians put into positions of power. I mean, the other aspect is, and we've seen this in Australia when they haggled over what kind of a republic they would like to be, a prime minister who's enacting a new constitution is not interested in creating a new boss for himself. He's not going to say there will be a president over me and he will have all these powers. They're not interested in doing that. They're interested in getting rid of any boss that they have. And in this case, that would be the monarch.
Well, you could end up in a situation too. So this is for those who are interested in electing a head of state. So replacing the king with someone who's elected, depending on how you do it, you could end up with a situation where you end up arguably with a president, let's say directly elected by the people, gets a higher vote than the prime minister of the day. So who gets to hold the greater sway? I would argue you could end up with confusion in the system and infight. And that's why I said, you know, somewhat tongue-in-cheek earlier, be careful what you wish for, because you'll end up with a National Party-aligned president or a Labour Party-aligned president. And look, speaking very personally, I just don't think that's a good idea. I mean, I loved being in Parliament. I love being a politician. But I can tell you now, you don't need more. Mm. You're better off having someone like the king, the sovereign, sitting outside of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, really, no matter how you slice up the idea of this republic, you know, this ideal model that we'll all be promised, if you allow Parliament to appoint a president, which is how many presidencies are filled, you know it will be their friends. It will be an ex-politician. It will be somebody with great notoriety like that. And they will be expected to just be a pointless rubber stamp. And I really don't see the value in that. You know, I mean, the value of the monarchy is in having that little bit of possible maneuvering room. But that's just if you're going to have it appointed. If you're going to have the president elected, as you've mentioned, it's entirely possible that there will be gridlock, that a president from one party will simply obstruct the government of another party. And if you're not a fan of the parliament that's been elected, you may like a president who blocks that, but the shoe will be on the other foot in a few years. And that's a recipe for us to get nothing done ever.
Well, that's often why, you know, again, over many years in parliament, I've had people come to me and say, oh, look, I just wish we had a president or even a governor general that could just override. I don't like this government policy, to have it overridden. And you've just nailed the point of why it's not a good idea, because the shoe does move. It will be on the other foot. And one day we'll find ourselves going, oh, I love this policy. And yet a president with a different set of views overrides it. It's just not where we want to be. And so I suppose that's one of the key reasons why you want an apolitical head of state. And there's a lot of conventions around that, which sometimes they argue Charles has breached a little bit where he's opining. But, I mean, we're not talking anything particularly substantial. They keep out of politics.
Well, I think you've actually raised a really interesting point there. For a long time, when the king was the Prince of Wales, he did weigh in on issues such as architecture, environmentalism, conservation, many of the issues that are actually quite important to a lot of New Zealanders. But people used this as an argument against him to say, oh, well, you know, the monarch shouldn't ever weigh in on this. Well, Charles was clear that he wouldn't when he was the monarch. And to his credit, in the last nearly 2 years, he has not weighed in on those issues. He did the work that he was passionate about before he was king. But now that he is king, he understands that it is his job to represent all people, regardless of what side of any issue they might be on. You know, he is there to represent the whole country.
We've chatted through a number of topics and look and been incredibly conscious of the time you've given us. So I just want to finish on three quick C's, and this is no pun on Charles's name. I want to talk about the charitable side of the monarchy, the celebrity side, for want of a better term, and the cost side. And then I'm going to get you to answer the quiz that I had earlier. So, yeah, just quickly talk us through the monarch or the monarchy and its role in charity and raising funds for people.
Well, you know, see, I mean, this is a really interesting example. When people say, oh, we should just boot the royal family out, we should just get rid of them, I always think of how the royals might interpret that. They might say, oh, this is very sad. This is very embarrassing. We're very hurt. I guess we're leaving. And I'm sure they would feel those things. But by the same token, we would have essentially released from most social obligation some very wealthy people who can now retire to tropical islands somewhere and lie around on a beach all day. And I think that whatever someone's opinion of the monarchy might be, they have to acknowledge that this is an incredibly hardworking family where we see hundreds and hundreds of events undertaken by each of the senior members every year. You know, they do this because they believe it is their responsibility. It is their duty to do this. And they do it out of regard for their country, whether it's the UK or when they're doing it down here in New Zealand or Australia. You know, they do this because they think it's important. And I think we've gotten a really good deal out of that, that people who could have retired to an island somewhere and slept on a beach all day instead slog away most days of the week at charitable events, at good causes, drawing the limelight that they have to worthy concepts. So,
yeah. And they make hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, they do. Absolutely. Look, I mean, just
not for themselves.
No. Absolutely. Just before Charles became king, I think they had said was something like he had raised that year £250 million, which is what, about half a billion New Zealand dollars, just that year for charitable causes with his charities around the world. And that is an incredible achievement. And that kind of ability is the sort of thing we actually need to be making more use of.
Well, that sort of links us into the second C. So we talk about the charity. So you talk about almost a half a billion dollars. And we have the likes of the Prince's Trust in New Zealand. But you're beginning to get onto the second C now, which is their I know you don't like this because we've talked about it before, but it's their celebrity, their status, which, well, you've argued before that they are so well known in the world, we should use this, leverage it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when we think about the monarchy, certainly under the previous queen, Queen Elizabeth II, there was always a question of what hat was she wearing? What kind of purse was Kate going to carry? And these sorts of things, none of which I know anything about. I have very little interest in those things. But they are among the most famous people on the planet. And it is, I think, a resource for New Zealand to utilize when we can say our head of state is Charles III. I mean, that's a name known around the world, even over these last 2 years, you know, as he's assumed this new position. We need to make better use of that. You know, wherever he goes, he has the media following him. And this is true of William, and this is true of George. This is true of most members of the working royal family. That's not just for the sake of the tabloids. That has a real practical value. So when members of the royal family come to New Zealand for a tour of the country, the things we put on that tour really matter. They're usually about our arts and culture, our national values like conservation and environmentalism. They're about our industries, the things that we make and do here in New Zealand. And so, yes, we may pay for the king's travel expenses. Never a salary. We do not pay a member of the royal family a single cent from New Zealand. But we will pay their expenses when they're working here, which I think most people would agree is reasonable. But for that small investment, or relatively small investment, we get global coverage in all the major newspapers, on all the major television channels around the world. Because when Charles holds a kiwi, when William at the age of one holds a buzzy bee, these pictures went all over the world, and the world asked, what is this? How do we find these things? How do we get there? What can we do?
Well, I know when, I've forgotten what year it was in Parliament. Long and short, there was a parliamentary report that said for every dollar which New Zealand invests in a visit with the royal family, they get at least $10 back. It's, if you will, free coverage. When you've got everyone from the BBC to the New York Times to Vogue following everything they do, and I've escorted or been right behind Charles and Camilla once, the cameras are going the whole time. It's massive advertising.
Mm. And I think actually one of the other angles I just want to touch on there, because there will be some people out there who say, well, we'll stay in the Commonwealth even if we become a republic, and we'll still have the king and queen come visiting. You know, King Charles has been to Germany and to France recently, and they're not even in the Commonwealth. I would just like to point out that when the king travels to countries outside the countries that he is king of, it is at the behest of the British government. So when the monarch goes to Brazil, it is the British government requesting that the monarch go there, and it is pushing a British agenda in Brazil. And that is fundamentally different to what happens when a member of the royal family comes to New Zealand. That is at the request of the New Zealand government, and it is to push not a British agenda or any other agenda around the world. It is to address a New Zealand agenda. If we were to say, well, we'll become a republic, but we'll stay in the Commonwealth, yes, we might get a visit from them now and then. I think Brazil gets a visit from the royal family once every 30 or 40 years. And, you know, Brazil has, 100 million people in it. I don't know how many 4 million in New Zealand would get, but it is our way of steering the monarchy, of controlling our monarchy, our king, and our agenda.
I think the other point, too, I'd quickly make, because I am conscious of your time, we need to use the royal family more. So they are our royal family, okay? That he's the king of the UK, but he's also the king of New Zealand, Australia, Canada. We need to use him as the king of New Zealand to actually advertise New Zealand more. So I'm not just saying coming to visit us, but actually promoting New Zealand wool and meats and so forth. So something for the future. Just quickly then, because I said there were three C's around Charles and this king's birth. We talked about his charitable side, that celebrity, how they can use their public presence. But the other thing is cost. Does this cost New Zealand much at all to have a monarchy?
No. And that's another really wonderful thing. You can have the best system of government in the world, and if it costs a fortune, it's not going to last very long. As I mentioned, we do not pay a single cent to any member of the royal family. In fact, even the British really don't pay salaries to members of the royal family. We tend to cover their expenses when they're working for us. So that's actually quite a deal to have the most famous man in the world as our head of state at no cost to us. What we do pay for is his representative here, because obviously he can't be here most of the time. We do pay for a governor general and for government house and those sorts of things. But it is certainly not more expensive than having a president would be. We could assume that the president would move into government house, and so those costs would remain very similar. But we know that as a representative of the king, the governor general does not have quite as high a profile, does not need to push their own personal persona out into the rest of the country or even the world. So my guess is that any change to a republic will almost certainly have to come at an increased in cost.
It will, but I mean, they'll ultimately be, so this is now me making a statement, but they'll be ultimately political. Hmm. So they'll need their press secretaries, their spin doctors, they'll be absolutely needing to maintain their presence in some shape or form. Sean, I am incredibly conscious of your time. We have covered a lot today. Look, and particularly to listeners, it's very clear, as I said at the start, Sean and I are aligned on this. It's a king's birthday special, so it's obviously last weekend, but I wanted to bring these themes to you. But I welcome your feedback. There'll be those of you who completely disagree or have other questions, and of course you can always get in touch via email at info@realitycheck.radio or text us at 2057. Let me know what you think. In fact, if you've got particular challenges or questions, or you go, no, I think Dr. Palmer is wrong, well, let us know. In fact, I can bring Sean back on to, discuss those. But as part of today's show, Sean, I was getting a bit tongue-tied there on the S's. I did a bit of a quiz for people at the start, and I thought it'd be great if you could answer them. I'm confident you'll get, we have 11 questions, 10 and then a bonus question, but I'll put them to you to answer for everyone to wrap this session up. How many times, so I hope everyone, by the way, you've got your answers there and you haven't cheated and Googled, but how many times has Charles, as in, well, we used to know him as Prince Charles, now King, how many times has Charles visited New Zealand?
It has been 10 times so far, and I am very confident that there will be a few more in the years to come.
And just as a side note, because obviously I had to do some research, his last trip was down here with Camilla, and they were in Auckland, Waitangi, Christchurch and Kaikoura. I think that was in 2019. The second question, which royal went to school here in New Zealand?
He was known as Prince Edward at the time, but he is now known as the Duke of Edinburgh, having essentially inherited the title from his father.
And he was at Whanganui Collegiate. How many sovereigns or kings and queens have there been since the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi?
That's always, I do enjoy that question. There have actually been 7 since then. And I suspect we'll probably talk about them a little bit more as we go down.
Well, can you name them? Yeah. Who are the 7?
Yeah, I probably could. They would be Victoria, her son Edward VII, his son George V, his son Edward VIII, his brother George VI, and his daughter, Elizabeth II. And now we have her son, Charles.
Now you're just showing off.
Yeah, I know.
Question number, well, you'd probably expect that of someone with a doctorate in the nature of the crown and monarchy. Question number four was, what is the name of New Zealand's current Governor General?
I always despair at the answers that people give to this because, you know, you can get, people will put in the Prime Minister's name, they'll put in all sorts of things. At any rate, Dame Cindy Kiro is the current Governor General.
Question number five was, who was the first king or queen of New Zealand?
Ah, well, now, see, this is a tricky question. See, I would say, I think you could make an argument that Queen Victoria was through the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. But there are others who would say, well, now, hang on, that was because New Zealand was part of the British Empire at that point, and she was the queen of the British Empire. New Zealand wasn't really independent until what this passing of the Statute of Westminster in the 30s and in New Zealand the 40s. So you could make an argument then that the first truly independent king of New Zealand was King George the VI. You might maybe argue George the V. But the first monarch to actually have the title sovereign of New Zealand was Elizabeth II.
So for those who are keeping track, I'll give you any of those for answers. I had put down Victoria, but if you had any of those names which Dr. Palmer just used, they can be correct. Question number six was, who is third in line to the throne of New Zealand?
All right. Well, first in line is Prince William. Second in line is Prince George. So third in line is his sister, Princess Charlotte.
We've sort of already answered some of this in question seven. Name all of Prince William and Catherine's children.
Ah, well, so George, Charlotte, and their little brother, Louis.
Do you know their ages?
Oh, my goodness. No, I'm going to chalk that up to Royalist. I'm afraid I don't know those.
Make sure you email me those if you do know or text. Question number eight. Is Charles the King of the United Kingdom or King of New Zealand?
Well, the correct answer is certainly both. He is the king of those countries. But when anybody says to you, oh, but he's the king of the UK, his primary focus is the UK, I would respond with, you know, he's also the king of Canada. Is there something you have against the UK?
Question number nine was, is Charles an admiral of the fleet, a field marshal, and an air marshal in New Zealand?
Yes, he is, and has been since before his mother passed away. So he is the only Admiral of the Fleet in New Zealand, the only Field Marshal of our army, and the only Air Marshal in the Royal New Zealand Air Force.
And question 10 was, if Prince George becomes George the VII, is that the highest number of any name?
Right. So, yeah, on the assumption that someday after King William the V, that there will be a King George the VII. The answer to that is no. As I've mentioned, there was an Edward the VII in this list that we've had of monarchs in New Zealand. But there was also an Edward the VIII, the one who abdicated. And just for good measure, there was also a Henry the VIII, which I think most people would be aware of.
And look, this is a bonus question, one that I didn't share with listeners. It's one I'm going to throw at you right now. Since 1840, how many of New Zealand's heads of state have been women?
Ah, that's a good one. So of those seven monarchs that have been our heads of state, two were women, Victoria and Elizabeth. But what's really interesting about that is if we were to look at about 184 years since the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, there has been a woman on the throne, Victoria and Elizabeth, for 130 of those years, which means that we have had a female head of state 70% of New Zealand's modern history. Outside of these Commonwealth realms, there is no country that has ever had that kind of female representation at the top level. I mean, there are a lot of countries today that have had no women in the top office ever.
I hope you guys have done well with the quiz. I'll be interested to know. You're welcome through, again, the email or text, or obviously through social media. Let us know how you did with those 10 questions. Otherwise, I just want to say, Sean, a big thank you for making the time for coming on Reality Check and here on Speak Free. Have really appreciated you talking us through all elements of the monarchy here in New Zealand.
Oh, well, I look forward to hearing what comments have come back and what we can cover in the next round.
Well, thanks very much.
We live in a world where politicians and the media and the dominant culture is to slice and dice us and divide us. What I love about RCR is it brings us together, joins us up, makes us feel part of something bigger than us, and builds this great human connection.
Within 2 weeks of my having a show on RCR, we had journalists from the legacy media begging the Prime Minister to cancel RCR. That's how used to suppressing the truth the legacy media have become. That's how quickly we can make a difference. They failed to cancel me, they failed to cancel RCR.
It's all about freedom in the end. Freedom of thought, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of travel, medical freedom, freedom to bring up your own family as you see fit, freedom to say the climate crisis is a scam, freedom to say that the transgender movement is sinister, freedom.
It's absolutely vital we keep this narrative going, because certainly the other side, the alarmist side, is really amping it up. I just find using climate and everything around climate, that was quite funny, really, wasn't it?
We are here to really transform the shape of what media is going forward, which is such an honor and such an exciting stage to be in.
You've got to have both sides of the story, and that's what we're here to do.
We want to have these conversations. We want to be able to talk about the stuff. We want to be able to say the things that you guys are saying to yourself in whispered conversations in case someone else might hear at the supermarket.
Here, what we get is a checking of reality. And checking out reality is the very essence of our mental health and our survival.
Well, hi, everyone. I'm incredibly excited to have a good friend of mine, Bruce, from America. And you're going, there's lots of Bruces in America, but I can assure you there's only one Bruce that I know. He's a top bloke. I've known him for many, many years. In fact, we might have to share over the coming weeks a little bit of our histories. But Bruce, great to have you on the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Simon.
Now, of course, America's a big place, so you're in the state of Maryland. So you better quickly tell my listeners where that is.
Yes, it's funny. New Zealand is such, we just think of it, you guys are on the other side of the world. Maryland, we are, as you look at the United States, we're on the East Coast, right in the middle of the East Coast. You'll see a body of water called the Chesapeake Bay. We are about 4 hours south, due south of New York City. I'm about where I am right now. I'm about an hour from the White House, from downtown D.C. And I worked in downtown D.C. about a block from the White House for about 20 years. So that's a little bit about where Maryland is.
Well, we're going to have to tap you a lot more and your history. I mean, as I say, I've known you for a long time, and I think listeners are going to be fascinated to learn more about you. But, I mean, one of the reasons you just touched on it, the White House and politics. I mean, throwing you right in, what is happening in America at the moment? We seem to have court cases left, right, and center. What is going on in America right now?
In America. It's funny. You guys all call us America. I don't ever think of ourselves as America. It's here in the States. In the States, we are polarized, hugely polarized, where neither side can see reason of the other. We've just been through a harrowing 2 weeks of Donald Trump's trial, which was, pardon the pun, trumped up charges that everyone agrees on, both left and right. They resurrected, it's called a zombie case. And it was basically just a bookkeeping error that he paid his attorney, and the attorney tried to cover up his meeting with a porn star, Stormy Daniels, I think her name was. But it was all just a bookkeeping thing, and they made it a huge issue. And now he's a convicted ex-president. Nobody, this is brand new, uncharted territory. Nobody knows where this is going. And then we start this. Well, it was yesterday, Monday morning. Hunter Biden, who is President Biden's second oldest son, his oldest son, Beau, died. And Hunter is a piece of work, if you've done any research at all, cocaine addict, and he's up on gun charges. He bought a gun, apparently, and said he was not addicted to cocaine. So they've made that a huge charge. And so that's on the left. The left of the Democrats, the right of the Republicans.
It sounds like it's using the whole legal system there for sort of political ends, as you say. Is it Trump's on 34 charges, and now there's talk of if he goes to prison, he'll need a security service detail the whole time. But yeah, and he's on charges. They're taking Biden or Beau, no, Hunter Biden. Is that this? I mean, is your impression that basically the court system there has been used for political purposes? Is that a fair observation?
Absolutely, and I don't think anyone disagrees. It's that our Attorney General Merrick Garland, he's the chief lawkeeper, member of the cabinet of Biden. He was up for Supreme Court, and Supreme Court is a lifetime appointment under Trump. Managed to make it so he was not eligible for the Supreme Court. And I think rumor has it, or there's talk of, that Merrick Garland is just being vindictive and has kind of got a vendetta, and it's judicial warfare almost.
So, I mean, what are the ordinary Americans on the streets? I mean, look, yeah, what are the those in the States? I've got to get my language right. You'll come over here and give me a kick up the backside.
Yeah, just in the States.
Yeah. Are they talking about this a lot, or are people over it? Have they already factored in Trump's background and behaviors and Hunter's behavior? I mean, what are people talking about there?
It's an interesting question. That's people you hear the news. It's wall to wall. You can't avoid it. But it's the elephant in the room. People are so polarized. It's like you don't talk religion or politics. You know? And even more so now, because when you begin to talk politics, you're either going to talk to somebody who agrees with you, wall to wall, or we'll get in your face and be very, very angry. And nobody wants to get yelled at.
Well, my memory when I was living in the States years ago, and of course when we first met, election time, there are signs everywhere. Unlike New Zealand, people keep their politics relatively close. But I remember going, I mean, we're talking in the 2000s, 1999, 2000, but there were Republican signs and flags, there were Democrat signs and flags on most yards. Is that something? Yeah, is that still going?
Yard signs, yes. We've got a major, major election coming up in, 6 months, or 5 months, I guess. That's for the president. Yeah, the way we operate, a senator is elected for 6 years. A member of the House of Representatives is elected for 2 years, and the president for four. So every 2 years, the Senate changes over one-third, the entire members of the House of Representatives, and then every 4 years is the president. So every 2 years, there's something going on. Where am I? Good question again. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, well, you were just saying of just how visual, if you will, the elections are in America. In New Zealand, few people would put up a yard sign.
When an election comes up, yes, there's yard signs all over the place. There's Trump signs. And you can kind of get a bearing as to who's doing well by the number of their yard signs. For the school board, for the Senate, for the House, we have a state Senate and then the United States Senate. So all that gets elected too. And everybody's got a yard sign. We just had
something
primary,
actually we should.
So,
oh, sorry, Karen, the primaries.
We just had a primary, so everybody who lost, their signs came down, but everybody who won, their signs are still up until November.
We're going to have to sit down over subsequent weeks and tease some of this out because New Zealand's not familiar with primaries or the fact that you elect so many people. It might surprise New Zealanders or Kiwis of how many roles are actually elected.
Every 2 years, one-third of the United States government changes.
Incredible. Of course, in New Zealand, we're really simple. Parliaments are only elected once every 3 years, everyone out and then everyone in. We're pretty simple. We're pretty simple down here.
No, in their infinite wisdom, they don't allow term limits. So they can basically get elected and stay there forever because they get all the benefits of being an incumbent.
Which seems to be a lot. We should really tease. We should tease this out another time because I'll have to keep rolling. But Bruce, look, a huge thanks to you for agreeing to come on the show. I think this is going to be a well enjoyed part of the show. So just great to have your voice there in America, in the wonderful state of Maryland.
You have no idea how flattered I was, Simon, when I got your note to say, hey, would you like to do a report on America? Yeah, this is great. And we do hang our dirty laundry out for everyone to see. But nobody knows exactly what we're doing indoors. So, yeah, this will be fun. And please, if anybody out there who's listening and has a further question or whatever, feel free to contact Simon and, yeah, I'll answer anything you want to know.
I think that's actually a great way to end it. So to listeners, do get in touch. You can obviously get hold of me at info@realitycheck.radio or text us at 2057. Yeah, if you've got questions of Bruce, what's happening in America, let us know. We'll pass it on. Hey, Bruce, I'll let you get back to home and family and we'll talk again next week.
Oh, I'm so looking forward to it. See you, everybody.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, it's mailbag time, and I have to say, one of my favourite times in the show. I love getting your feedback, so as always, make sure you message me and the team at inbox@realitycheck.radio, and of course you can text as well to 2057. A lot of feedback from last week, so not going to be able to get through it all. I'm going to summarise some elements. I've got a few people here making suggestions who I should be interviewing. Tom Remfer was one suggestion. It notes the person who's written in, a Top Gun pilot, and someone who's recently written a book on illegal mandates, particularly in the armed forces. Also a suggestion to interview Julia Defresne, if that's how I say Julia's name. So we're going to have to follow those two up and learn a bit more about them. Marilyn says, thanks, Simon. Really enjoying your program and guests. So I'm delighted at that. Always open to suggestions for guests. We had, of course, Nick Hain on from the Free Speech Union. Ursula says, when are we going to talk about the root cause of the free speech problem in New Zealand, which they deem to be poor quality teacher education? Look, I certainly think that's part of it, Ursula. I think another part, too, is just making sure we sit around the dinner table, if you will, with our young ones and make sure we have good free conversations there. Andrew notes a must for universities where propaganda really cranks up. And so Andrew's referring that, you know, it's a real must, if you will, to listen to what Nick and others at the Free Speech Union are saying. Sel was asking me the name of Paul Moon, Dr. Paul Moon's book. So we interviewed Paul last week. His book is literally titled Ans Westra, Ans, A-N-S, Westra, the Dutch New Zealand photographer. Great book. Certainly suggest you get it. Athena says, hi, Simon, listening to your show, appreciated you reading out the not so positive feedback. And while I have similar sentiments with those that wrote in, I admire the way you handled it. Also, Paul Moon is a national treasure, and I'm so grateful I studied the treaty under him before it morphed into what it currently is. Keep up the great work. Well, thanks, Anthea, I think it's always important actually to read what is both positive and negative. And if people are wondering, some of the more challenging parts are coming soon. So other lovely comments from people around. Rachel Heidi says, cute chicken story. And Alan says, it gave me the warm fuzzies listening to you, lovebirds. Well, as I keep saying, Rachel's a pretty amazing woman. Jackie notes with the interview I held with the Taiwanese ambassador, Joanne Oh, great interview. It shows RCR is aiming for a broad mix of people, topic, and ideas. And that, Jackie, is actually one of the key things I'm trying to do. Some feedback, too, on my interview with Dr. Stephanie Warboys. She's from the Maxim Institute and talks about trust in Parliament. Bronwyn says, I was very happy to learn a lot more about Taiwan. But I also found it really interesting that Stephanie Warboys says it's a problem that we as a nation have lost trust in our government. But I view that as a very good thing because I'm no longer willing to believe what they, the government, tell me at face value or blindly do what they want me to do. And I think actually Bronwyn's right. I think it's actually one of the elements that's come from that distrust of government. And in many ways, I think actually quite healthy to have a skepticism. Andrew notes, we do not know our politicians due to mass-scale democracy. Our politicians have evolved into salesmen, and they're nothing much more nowadays. I think actually Andrew's got, a partly right there, actually. A lot of it becomes a sales job. You know, what the leadership of the day wants sort of becomes the narrative. And you can see a lot of politicians just always kicking in line with that rather than expressing their own views. And then we've got around the whole protest. Obviously, we read out the mailbag, had a few discussions with the likes of Paul Brennan and Cam. Mike says, really enjoyed your program. But I'm not quite satisfied with the depth of my – sorry, I'm now paraphrasing because thanks, Mike. It was really good feedback, but also quite lengthy. I've just been listening to your interview, and I was thinking that even though I heard what you explained about the Parliament protest, I'm not quite satisfied with the depth of it. Please tell us more about the pressures and your motivations to not stand up for free speech and why you didn't talk to the protesters. This is important to create trust. Thanks, Mike. Then Michael says, where is it? He was listening to me and the interviews. He was enjoying it. And he says, Simon started to explain his reasons why he didn't come out, but he didn't add anything to what he was saying last week. And I have a feeling his explanation is not going deep enough. People lack courage, but defend it with reasonable sounding arguments. And that's from Michael. And then Liz is noting, again, it's coming out of the free speech. She says, my gripe with you, as in Simon, is we all came from the right side of history and stood for our convictions, and yet you sat in Parliament and signed a piece of paper saying you'd not speak to us outside. And then Mike from Foxton's noting, is a staunch Boilermaker. He knows what standing strong and united means, and you, or Simon in this case, seem to be a soft approach, placating the wants and needs around you. An apology on mainstream media would show what you mean. And then others, Stephen says, no apology from Simon. And what I think's the clanger, that explanation is BS. There was no name on that, but I think that's the clanger and cuts to the chase. Hey, look, a couple of quick points on that. My explanations are my explanations. I'm pretty upfront with the reasoning I give. And I'd slightly push back on Michael saying that, you know, reasonable sounding arguments sort of mask a lack of courage. I think actually reason is a courageous act in itself. There are reasons. That may not be the excuses people like, but there are reasons for things. I would note there were no pieces of paper. I think it was Michael who had noted that parliamentarians had signed a piece of paper. Just on that small point, there were no, well, not that I ever saw any paper or agreements in that regard. To Mike from Foxton, who suggests a lot of us are soft, I'd have to, with a smile on my face, I'd have to gently push back on that one. As someone who's been everything from a prison chaplain at the old Mount Eden, stabbed with dirty needles, haven't had a soft life. I stand up for what I believe in. But, you know, part of that too is I make my calls and judgments as I've described before. Guys, I will end it there. I'm always keeping the mailbag close. I look forward to re-engaging. Look, hit me up on any of these topics again, new topics from the show today. And as always, you can hit us up at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text at 2057. Thank you, everyone, for joining me on the show today, this somewhat King's Birthday special. Look, I hope you enjoyed the conversations with Dr. Sean Palmer and Tania Unkovich. Look, I'd love to hear your feedback on all or anything we discussed. And I was delighted to introduce my mate, Bruce from America. We're going to make that a regular part of the show. So look, doesn't matter if you've got thoughts on Sean's take on the monarchy and mine, Tanya's view on things, Bruce's perspective. If you've got thoughts or questions, please get in touch at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text through at 2057, or of course, jump onto any of the social media channels. But again, thank you so much for joining me this week. I look forward to chatting again next week.
Celebrating Western values, our democracy, and our rights, and hearing perspectives from right here in New Zealand and overseas. We live in a big, well-connected world, so join Simon O'Connor as he talks to guests from home and abroad about the issues that really matter. Join us at 10 a.m. every Friday, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.